Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has come to our attention through her work on a very familiar part of the battlefront in the war for the free world, Russia, is Alexis Marachek. She is these days a research associate for Russia and Eurasia at the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. She writes prolifically and has been published widely. Piece that particularly caught my eye appeared in the Heritage Foundation's Daily Signal last week, entitled "The Life of Jailed Russian Dissident Alexei Navalny is in Peril. The U.S. Must Act to Save Him." Alexis, it's good to have you with us. Welcome for the first time, I believe, to Secure Freedom Radio.
Yes, thanks, Frank, so much for having me on.
Well, the pleasure is mine, particularly because I think it's so important that we understand what is going on at the moment with respect to this rather heroic figure, Alexei Navalny. Tell us a little bit about him and why it seems Vladimir Putin has it in for him.
Yes, Alexei Navalny has been the leader of Russia's opposition movement over the last decade or so. Maybe even longer. He is seen as a main opponent against Putin. He has challenged Putin's policies in the past. He has revealed the Kremlin corruption and just the cronyism going on. And it seems like the Kremlin just does not find him to be a very favorable person in Russia.
That's putting it mildly. They've tried to kill him.
I would remind us
of that story of what happened when they poisoned him and how he managed to cheat death in that circumstance.
Yes. So the Kremlin sent some operatives last August to his hotel room, and they poisoned him with Novichok, which is a military-grade nerve agent. And just a couple days later, he was transported to a hospital in Berlin, Germany. And he was there for several months recovering. And he bravely decided to return to Russia this past January with his wife, Yulia. And upon arrival at the airport, he was arrested. And then he was tried in court for an offense he committed several years ago, but it's based on trumped up charges. It's not really a real offense.
A classic Soviet style show trial, I think it's fair to call it, wouldn't it?
Exactly. And now he resides in a penal colony, and he has not been granted access to good medical care. And for that reason, he has decided to go on hunger strike. And he's been on hunger strike for 2 or 3 weeks now. And he is basically on the brink of death. So it's a very severe situation now.
And tell us a little bit about this penal colony at Pokrov. You've described it as not just an institution for incarcerating individuals who are deemed to be criminals. What kind of treatment is he getting besides, obviously, a lack of medical treatment?
Yes. So the Pokrov or IK2 penal colony is just a little ways outside of Moscow. And it is a place that is meant to intimidate and promote fear in the inmates and in just the Russian population in general, I believe. And they have been going into Navalny's room every single night, usually every hour, every 2 hours, waking him up, coming in very loudly. So they're not allowing him to get very good sleep. And then he came down with some medical issues. He was feeling numbness in his legs and his hands, just having some other issues. And his lawyers have been fighting.
Could this have something to do with the fact that he's beaten by these guards?
It could very well be due to that fact, but it could also be connected to his poisoning by Novichok last August. It could be some residual effects.
It's amazing that he survived. I mean, that's serious chemical weapon poisoning. And I'm amazed that, first of all, he recovered to the extent he did. And then, of course, as you say, that he had the courage to go back to fate that it was predictably of the kind he's getting. So, Alexis, this has come to the point where his mistreatment as a figure opposing Vladimir Putin is now a bit of a cause célèbre in the European Union and in the Biden administration. Tell us what they're saying and may do to try to help him. And more to the point, what should we be doing to try to prevent what seems to be in prospect now, which is a second attempt at murdering him?
Yes. So the United States has sanctioned Russia for Navalny's poisoning and imprisonment. We sanctioned Russia, I think, in early March. The European Union, I believe, has also sanctioned Russia for the crimes committed against Navalny. So far, the United States has not done any more actions, but I think this past week it came out that through private diplomatic channels, the U.S. is trying to advocate for Navalny to get out of prison and, you know, stay alive and all these things. I think that the U.S. needs to do more, but it is good that it seems like we're working through these private diplomatic channels. And so that's going on. And I'm sorry, what was the last part of your question?
Well, that does seem as though there is now a determined effort to murder Navalny once again. Presumably, they hope that it won't be on the hands of the Russian authorities, but that seems difficult under these circumstances, particularly. But what more should we be doing to try to stave that off? Do you think there are further sanctions or other measures that could have a profound effect on the calculations of the Russians as to what the cost-benefit analysis is here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do believe the U.S. should impose more sanctions on Russia. For example, Alexei Navalny himself came out with a list of 35 different Russian business people who could be personally sanctioned as punishment and for what's going on, just all the corruption and what's happening to Navalny himself. And then
these are cronies of Putin, presumably. Right?
Exactly. And but we could also consider imposing Magnitsky sanctions. These would be specifically for the human rights abuses being committed. But we also could get more creative and sanction the authorities who are in charge of the Vladimir Oblast, where the Pokrov penal colony is located, or we could sanction the authorities themselves who work at that penal colony. So there are actually a lot of different ways we could impose more sanctions on Russia.
Magnitsky sanctions, of course, were named for another political prisoner who was murdered in the Russian gulag, and it's ominous indeed that this may be the kind of repercussion that will happen should Navalny meet a similar fate. Alexei Marychuk, it's very, very good to hear from you, and thank you for your time. The work that you're doing at the Heritage Foundation is important. I hope you'll keep us abreast of it with further visits soon. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we will speak with Sam Faddis about what Putin is up to more broadly and what the Chinese are doing, perhaps to take advantage of it, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say, Charles Sam Faddis is a man who has served our country with great distinction in the uniform of the United States Army and out of uniform as an undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's run for Congress. He's served as an assistant attorney general in Washington State. He's written best-selling books, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He has also been a great contributor to the public policy debate, both in his superb web platform and magazine.com, and right here on Secure Freedom Radio. We're always pleased to have him with us. Welcome back, Sam.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You have been writing about a couple of things that are top of mind for both of us, obviously, and your insights are so important. Let me talk with you, first of all, about something we visited a little bit with Alexis Mrachik about a moment ago, and that is what Vladimir Putin is up to. And you have a piece up at and talking about an opening that Putin senses with the Biden administration in town. What is that opening? What does it portend?
Well, specifically in that case, really talking about Ukraine, as most people are probably aware, there's been sort of on and off fighting between Ukraine and Russia since 2014. But we now see a very ominous, massive strategic buildup of Russian forces along the border with Ukraine, and including air forces, naval forces in the Black Sea, naval forces being moved from the Caspian Sea. And maybe most ominously, if you look at this strategically, a lot of Russian forces moving in Belarus. And, you know, for folks that aren't familiar with the geography, what that portends is the possibility of the Russians opening a completely second front against the Ukrainians, and suggests that what they have in mind is not just nibbling off a little piece of Ukraine, but potentially a much deeper strike. And, you know, what I'm suggesting is that they have taken the measure of the guy sitting in the Oval Office, and they've seen his track record, and they see his current condition and his team. And they have assessed, I think quite rightly, that he's not going to do anything at all to push back on them. And if there's, you know, this is the golden opportunity to really make a major move against Ukraine.
A lot to chew on there. It was reported by Michael McCormick in his book about Joe Biden. This was a former transcriber of Joe's various musings as vice president, that Vladimir Putin did not have much regard for then Vice President Biden when he was relatively on his game. It's hard to believe that it would be more, you know, respectful, more concerned about what Biden would do in this environment. And you talk about a second front. Sam Faddis, the thing that's of concern is this may well be a third front or possibly a fourth front in a conflict-riddled world that has been brought to us, at least in part, by this perception of the weakness, the lack of resolution, the lack of, well, capability of the Biden-Harris administration. If China piles on, and possibly Iran, and who knows, maybe North Korea as well as others, when you see this teeing up, it makes what is now quite ominous, as you say, for our friends in Ukraine, a considerably bigger problem. Let's talk a bit about another piece you had at Ad Magazine last week about China finishing the job in the South China Sea, which again suggests that they are willing to work in partnership with their strategic allies in Russia to capitalize on this window of opportunity. Tell us about it.
You know, circa 2013, when Joe was vice president, is the infamous trip when Joe and Hunter Biden fly into Beijing, and Joe goes off to meet with the Chinese officials, and Hunter goes off to take possession of first $1 billion and then $1.5 billion in cash. And all of that happened at the point where Joe Biden was appointed to be supposedly Barack Obama's point man on stopping Chinese expansionism. And the Chinese were in the midst of building these islands in the South China Sea that they have since completed and militarized. So Joe flies in. He's the man who's going to stop this. Hunter picks up the cash. They leave. Joe, of course, doesn't do anything. Barack does not do anything. And the Chinese militarize the entire South China Sea. Now they are, with Joe back in the White House, flooding the Chinese Sea with what amounts to a naval militia. They have literally thousands of vessels that sort of masquerade as fishing vessels, but in fact work for the People's Liberation Army and are armed and trained and equipped by them. And they're sort of a what we would call a gray force. They are a military force that the Chinese can sort of deny is working for them. And they have flooded the China Sea with hundreds of these vessels. So they're just taking the next step in shoving everybody else out and making this a, this is now reality. I mean, they've claimed it, the area, for a long time. Increasingly, they are producing a reality on the ground. It won't matter what you say. And they've obviously sized up the man and his team, and what they're hearing from his team is exactly what, the Obama said back in 2013, things about respecting international norms and
tweets.
All of this other
lots
stuff.
Lots of tweets.
A lot of tweets from the Secretary of State loves his tweets. And, maybe Xi's not on Twitter. I don't know. But apparently these tweets, strangely enough, don't stop the communist Chinese.
Maybe he is actually, as you say, taking the measure of these groups and can safely disregard the earnest tweets. But let's talk about what this portends, the effective domination. You say facts on the ground, of course, this is facts at sea, but the control of those waters effectively through the combination of these fortified bastions across the region and now this vast array of armed and armored fishing vessels, the maritime militia. What does that mean for the threats that we're perceiving are intensifying from the Chinese Communist Party to Taiwan? Sam Faddis.
Right. Well, of course, this is all occurring against the backdrop of the fact that the Chinese also are claiming and pushing against a whole slew of other islands that are outside of the South China Sea. So this is part of a much bigger push. But even just the South China Sea, take a look at the trade patterns in the world. You see something like one third of the world's trade runs through the ocean. This is like a dagger held to the throat of Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. Effectively, the Chinese are in a position anytime they want to shut down all trade. They don't have to move forces there. With the existing forces, missiles, aircraft based on these islands, with these fishing vessels out there, they can simply stop all world trade right now. They could do it any day, any moment they want. And we have allowed them to do this. And again, obviously, they know that they're not going to get anything from Tony Blinken other than some tweets and some stern finger wagging, and they don't care. And it is very, very ominous that we increasingly see formal cooperation, for instance, between the Iranians and the Chinese. So it's not some conspiracy theory that maybe they're all getting together on this. We know they're all getting together on this, and they all know that we have an administration that's not going to do anything about any of these things.
Sam, you've recently called our attention through the Accountability Initiative, which can be found at accountabilityinitiative.org, to the guy who is the number three man in the Department of Defense, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, by the name of Colin Kahl. What can you tell us about him, and what would it signal to the Chinese, perhaps among other adversaries, that such an individual is in that job against the backdrop of what you've just described?
Right. So, I mean, Kahl is another one of these guys that seems they're all cut from exactly the same cloth. They're all coming back. They're coming back into federal service, having worked at some institute or another that is completely tied into the Chinese Communist Party and to what we call the United Front, which is a worldwide Chinese effort to co-opt the elites in all critical countries. In his case, he's lashed up with a particular institute at Stanford University that operates, it cooperates with Peking University. Peking University is transparently part of the worldwide Chinese spy apparatus. It's run by a former very senior Chinese intelligence officer. It's up to its eyeballs in recruiting individuals inside the United States, spying on the United States. There are formal investigations underway of its activities. It's a completely controlled institution. Scholars there say what the CCP tells them to say, write what it tells them to see, write what the CCP tells them to write. And if you look at what this institute that Kahl's coming from, that's lashed up with Peking University, produces, it's straight off of a Chinese propaganda sheet. every key point that the Chinese Communist Party transmits, this institute echoes that right down the line, to the point that sometimes it's so transparent that it's hard to read it and not start laughing, because it's just literally could have been written by Xi himself. And at the same time, steers completely clear of any criticism of the Chinese Communist Party. There are no concentration camps. There is no genocide. There is no forced organ harvesting. None of that exists in the world that this institute writes about. So that, as you said, now that's yet another guy in a very senior position in this administration who's coming straight out of Chinese United Front activity. So no wonder we're not pushing back.
If it weren't so serious, it would be a laughing matter, but it is deadly serious, especially in the environment you've just described. Sam Faddis, we're hard out of time, but there's much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so again next week. In the meantime, thank you for your great service to our country, including that you're rendering these days at andmagazine.com. Check it out, folks. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton, a conservative movement leader, about corporate America's push on, among other fronts, dismantling our energy security posture. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for our weekly visit with Bill Walton, the proprietor of The Bill Walton Show, a terrific podcast TV program, and the president of the Council for National Policy, one of the most important conservative organizations in the country. I'm proud to be a member of it, and he is its leader. And it's always good to have a chance to visit with him to get a perspective on major public policy issues of our day, drawing upon, among other things, his considerable and highly successful experience as a financial maven on Wall Street. Bill Walton, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, thank you. I love financial maven. Let's go with that in the future.
I know. we'll get your cards printed. So, Bill, there is this talk underway now out of the Biden administration that it's going to demonstrate its earnestness in conversations with foreign leaders in the next few days about climate change by embracing a 50% cut in U.S. carbon emissions by 2030. This is, to say ambitious is an understatement. To say harebrained, I think, may be more accurate. Talk a little bit about what's going on here with this idea of curbing carbon emissions. Is it feasible, and what will be the practical effects?
Well, the words spring to mind, suicide of the West. In the first place, it's quite clear that declaring CO2 a pollutant was wrongheaded. Life depends on CO2.
We admit it ourselves, don't we? Breathing out.
We do admit it ourselves, and we're going through all these contortions to get our temperature down by 1.5 degrees centigrade, or at least preventing it by going up. Then, and in response, we're going to be shutting down most of the oil and gas production in the world, and in return, we're promised the fantasy of green energy, which right now means wind and solar. And if you look at what happened in Texas in February during the cold snap, the electrical grid shut down because they depend 25% on wind. And guess what? I got cold and the wind wasn't blowing and there was no electricity.
Or the weather, the windmills were freezing, I think, was also part of the problem. And of course, there was snow on the solar panels.
You know what you needed? You needed some gasoline to get the windmills turning, or natural gas, yeah.
So, Bill, this may be a fool's errand to begin with, but that doesn't seem to be diminishing the enthusiasm of not just Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her ilk in the Green New Deal enterprise, but, John Kerry, the czar for climate change of the Biden administration, and the president himself. So what are we likely to see if, as evidently lots of your former colleagues on Wall Street and in corporate boardrooms across America are now insisting that this ambitious agenda be adopted?
Well, the ESG movement, environment, social governance, really Larry Fink is at the forefront with at BlackRock. They formed a coalition called We Mean Business, which has our old friends Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Coca-Cola as
The usual suspects, we call them.
The usual suspects, and they've demanded that our target has to be in a range of 50% reduction in emissions. Now, what this means is that Biden's going to have to pay for this. Well, he's calling to pay for it with the raising corporate tax rates. So once again, we have the CEOs of these major corporations calling for things that will hurt their shareholders. And, you know, further, we're entering into these agreements with countries that are going along nodding, this is a good thing, carbon ought to be cut, which I disagree is a problem, but that's not the point. The point is we've got agreements now with Japan, South Korea, and Canada, who are attending an Earth Day Leaders Summit, but guess who's not going to be participating in these? China, India, Brazil, which the three of them remain some of the biggest carbon emitters in the world. China, I believe, is responsible for 30% of the world's carbon emissions. And what they've agreed to is they're going to increase those emissions slower than they would otherwise.
And only if we pay them exorbitant sums. And as I understand it, there is now increasingly a problem that the pollution that China is emitting, much of it, you know, out of coal-fired power plants, apparently, is afflicting our West Coast with smog and noxious, you know, conditions. When we see all this taking place, Bill, it does seem as though this ESG crowd is cynically ignoring what China is up to. Indeed, Larry Fink personally is one of the great abettors of the Chinese Communist Party with the funding that he's providing, much of it out of unwitting American investors' portfolios and pension funds. No?
Well, it saddens me, really, that we could have these presumably very, very smart CEOs of these major corporations. And I'm not going to argue that Larry's not smart, but how he could come to believe all this is mystifying to me because it really amounts to imposing enormous tax in terms of cash and freedom on the West, and not requiring China to pay any price. And, you know, we've talked about before the China market with its 400 or 500 million consumers looms large in the eyes of these corporations, and they seem to be willing to pay any price to maintain access to it.
And the price can be enormous, including lose your company for many of them, I think, as the Chinese inevitably, you know, insist upon the transfer of your proprietary information, in some cases your factories, to be given access to their marketplace. And then ultimately, you're done because they then produce the stuff themselves.
Well, it's so troubling, really, because on another front, your Committee for Present Danger China is urging for a boycott of the Winter Olympics in Beijing or in China. And, you know, these same companies which are calling for this ban on carbon emissions in the West are all for holding an Olympic game in China, which would do a lot to burnish China's reputation, the same thing that was done for Hitler's regime in the 30s. I always have to say, look, this is not about the Chinese people. This is about the Chinese Communist Party. And they're looking for a public relations coup, and hosting the Olympics would be yet another one. They've already hosted the Summer Olympics, and this would be quite a burning issue, quite a great thing for them.
It certainly would. And this analogy, I think, is apt between what was done for Hitler and his regime and its ambitions being legitimated, the Nazi Party, and what the Chinese Communist Party would benefit from in these genocide games, as we call it. I hope people will check out this initiative that Bill's referred to at genocidegames.org to learn more about what's afoot here, the nature of the Chinese Communist Party, really as a transnational criminal organization, and of the kinds of companies that are enabling these games and thereby the CCP itself. Bill, let me turn to one last thing with you quickly before we have to part. As a leader of the conservative movement, I know you are very much concerned, as I think we all ought to be, about what Joe Biden has done to precipitate a true crisis at our southern border by essentially rescinding every single one of Donald Trump's sensible policies with respect to the border security and interior enforcement and building the wall and having people await asylum rulings in Mexico and so on. Joe Biden has now, I guess somewhat grudgingly, but nonetheless acknowledged that it is a crisis. It's unclear that he intends to do much to help alleviate it other than, well, actually exacerbate it by opening the doors to refugees, including from failed states. What on earth is up with all of that?
Well, he can call it a crisis, but I don't see any lines of action where he intends to do anything about it. You know, Frank, this seems to be part of the larger agenda the Democrats have now, which is to be a one-party state. You know, what they're doing with the election laws and with a permanent one-party state, and you know, what they're doing with the election laws and the notion that we're going to add four more justices to the Supreme Court or admitting Puerto Rico and District of Columbia to the union, thereby ensuring four more Democrat senators. This is just a long list of things. It's a naked power grab. And with immigration, they are simply their strategy is you admit these people, the odds are they'll vote Democrat and therefore ensuring a permanent majority. It's cynical beyond belief, and that the press is not covering this in that way is just another example why we need a free press.
And, you know, one other item that you could put in that litany is, of course, this effort to enact legislation known as H.R. 1 or S.1 in the Senate that would have the effect of essentially ensuring that any of those folks can, well, immediately become voters. They don't have to have citizenship. The mechanisms for fraud would enable them to be empowered to vote and further disenfranchise, you know, the administration's opponents.
Let me turn to you because I'm relatively newer to this. I was innocently doing private equity for three or four decades. Now I've turned to political and policy issues. And I come around to feeling like you and I have talked about the enemy within and the enemy without. The enemy without obviously being China. The enemy within, though, why is it that these same usual suspects keep showing up? You know, Apple, or not Apple, but Coca-Cola and Delta were also signatories to the climate letter. And they're also the ones, CEOs, they're calling out Georgia for passing very sensible voter protection laws. And yet they're against that. So my question for you, Frank, is how long has this enemy within been developing, and why have we all missed it until just now?
This is a subject for another conversation, Bill. We are hard out of time. This short answer is for quite some years, and we've let it get to this point. And shame on us for doing so. Thank you for your time, my friend.
Here. Let's talk about this.
Okay. We will be back with more on that next week. Bill Walton, again, thank you for your time and your great service to our country. We appreciate it so much. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will speak with Lawrence Peck about developments in South Korea and how they may have affected our elections last year and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to a man I admire greatly for his serious and rigorous study of a nation that is of great importance to this country. Its president will be visiting the White House next month, but he is a dubious customer, I think it's fair to say, as we'll be discussing with Lawrence Peck in this block of Secure Freedom Radio. Lawrence is a man who has studied closely what's going on in South Korea, in part because of his concerns about what's going on in North Korea. He is an advisor to a wonderful organization, the North Korean Freedom Coalition and the One Korea Network. He's also been a representative to the Conservative Political Action Conference that's been taking place in recent years in South Korea. Always a welcome guest here. Lawrence, good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me back again, Frank. It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. Lawrence, I wanted to get your take on something that happened last week before the Tom Lantos
Human Rights Commission of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, our colleague Gordon Chang, testified about what's going on in South Korea. And I wanted to take stock with you. Why is it that a nominal Western democracy that is an important ally of the United States is being scrutinized for human rights, shall we say, constraints, if not sort of authoritarian misrule?
The problem, Frank, is that in South Korea, earlier this year, there was a demand received from Kim Yo-jong, the younger sister and one of the top leaders of the North Korean regime, North Korean dictatorship. And she issued a demand to Moon and his government that they ban and criminalize the sending of information from the South into the North. It's oftentimes sent by balloon up in the air across the border, sometimes put in bottles and sent over the seas. Information about the outside world, information about the true nature of the North Korean regime, Bibles, anti-communist leaflets, even COVID protection masks. And what happened was, as a result of that demand, Moon and his party, the Democratic Party of Korea, the left-wing ruling party there, went ahead and eventually promulgated such a law, and it just went into effect earlier this month, suppressing the freedom of speech of the South Korean people to communicate and to get outside information to their brethren in the North.
And unfortunately, this is just one example of the kind of accommodation that Moon Jae-in is apparently prepared to engage in to notably promote reunification with North Korea on the North's terms. Is that right?
That's right. It was a kind of a preparation, an appeasement of the North, giving into their demands to make possible some kind of low-level federation between the North and the South, which Moon has been talking about for years. And that was the reason why, to their great credit, the Lantos Human Rights Commission of the U.S. Congress, one of the co-chairs of which was Chris Smith, agreed to Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey, agreed to hold these hearings and have some witnesses testify as to the very negative and anti-democratic impact of this new rule promulgated by Moon and his Democratic Party of Korea.
This brings me to the hopeful sign that some in South Korea are beginning to resist what Moon Jae-in is up to. It's often said, I think by you and others, Gordon Chang notably among them, on this program, that the people of South Korea are not in favor of what Moon is up to, especially with respect to reunification with the North, turning the whole place into, it would seem, one big repressive communist operation. Talk a little bit about the elections that took place last week in Seoul, the capital of South Korea, and one of its most important cities, Busan.
Yes, that was a hopeful sign to people who value freedom in South Korea. And the fact was that they had two key mayoral elections in the two largest cities in South Korea, Seoul, the capital, and Busan, down on the southeastern coast. In both cases, the candidates of the conservative pro-American opposition party, the People Power Party, won that election and won those two mayoral posts, which was a definite setback, even an embarrassment to Moon in almost his final year in office, because Moon only has a little bit over a year left and he will not be able to run again. And that was also significant because young people who had been, especially young males between the ages of, let's say, 18 and 29, who had been one of the core support groups in the past for Moon, turned against him and voted in large numbers for the conservative opposition, which is a hopeful sign.
It is indeed. There were concerns expressed by our colleague Grant Newsom, who is based in Japan, but made a special visit to South Korea last year to do a forensic drill down on the elections that took place that gave Moon Jae-in a supermajority in the parliament, elections that were deeply suspicious in terms of apparent Chinese intervention and fraudulent outcomes. Some say it was a dress rehearsal for what the Chinese did in our own elections. Would you see as
not only hopeful, the fact that the governing party was repudiated rather massively in these two mayoral elections, Lawrence Peck, but that maybe they've got the fraud wrung out of the electoral process in South Korea?
Yes, as you alluded to, there were irregularities reported in the previous election, April of 2020. And one thing that particularly struck me about it, just to share a little anecdote about that research by our colleague Grant Newsham, was that one aspect of that election was, for example, that Chinese nationals in Korea, in South Korea, were allowed to participate in the ballot counting process, which is something which would be quite shocking to your listeners, as it was quite shocking to Koreans. And when the populace there complained about it and protested about it, they were told by the National Election Commission there, supposedly a neutral body, but actually doing the bidding of Moon, citizens were told, well, these Chinese nationals involved in the election process would actually be more fair and just in their work than Korean citizens, because they didn't necessarily favor one South Korean party or the other.
And based on what you know of Moon and his ruling clique, is that accurate, Lawrence, that he is actually out of the Chinese thrall, or is he really just now increasingly a kind of, well, I guess the Chinese term for it is running dog, a sort of puppet or proxy?
Well, Moon's main concern always is ideological fixation and the fixation of the gang of people who he surrounded himself with, radicals from the 1980s, their version of our 60s radicals. They came of age in the 1980s in South Korea as opposed to the 60s here. Their main concern has always been cozying up to the North. And, proposing a kind of low-level federation with the North, which many people suspect would be largely on the North terms. But he also, Moon has, and this is of great significance and concern to Americans, he's been cozying up to communist China and giving speeches there in which he said he wanted Korea to be part of the Chinese dream, and not being willing to go ahead with U.S., Japanese, Indian, other nations' efforts to push back against Chinese threats and aggression in the region, kind of keeping a distance from that effort.
And joining the Belt and Road Initiative, as I understand it, in some form or fashion as well. There's so much more to talk with you about, Lawrence, because, among other things, Moon Jae-in is expected to visit Washington next month, and he will almost certainly be bringing with him some of this same kind of agenda that is not just pro-China, but deeply anti-American. And I want to visit with you in particular about influence operations that his government is running inside the United States, pro-North Korean influence operations. I guess some of them are actually working for the North Korean regime itself. But when you throw it all together, Lawrence, it is a very, very troubling picture about what's happening on the peninsula in both the North and the South. And we appreciate your expertise on the matter and look forward to talking with you further about it soon. So come back to us for that purpose, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.